Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today, we're bringing you the second part of a two-part conversation here during September, National Suicide Prevention and Awareness Month. We'll continue our conversation with Dr. Kathleen Chapman, who is with the Connecticut Psychological Association and the Connecticut Advisory Board for Suicide Prevention. We're going to be talking about this escalating public health crisis, how to recognize warning signs, and how to immediately engage a person you believe might be considering ending their own life. Then we're going to turn to the subject of agriculture and how the U.S. Department of Agriculture is supporting 10 key Connecticut farms and agricultural businesses with grants to build or improve renewable energy infrastructure and help rural agricultural producers and businesses lower their energy costs. And we're closing welcoming a couple of new friends to the program who have endured a tragic loss of one of their children and who have founded a nonprofit to fund research that's helping families across the nation and around the globe grappling with Niemann-Pick type C disease, also known as childhood Alzheimer's. We're going to tell you all about Dana's Angels Research Trust and how you can participate in their upcoming Dart to the Finish walk. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. The Anxiety and Mood Disorders Program at the Yale Child Study Center offers comprehensive evaluations and treatments for children and adolescents from ages 6 to 14 years. The program treats a range of anxiety disorders and fears like excessive worrying, social anxiety, difficulties or refusal to speak to other children or adults outside their immediate family, separation anxiety, anxiety related to school like taking tests or speaking in class, as well as specific fears. The program is currently conducting two large clinical trials to treat childhood anxiety. One is for children 6 to 12 and includes two effective treatments for childhood anxiety. The other is for children 10 to 14 and tests the effectiveness of a brief computer-based training that targets attentional processes to reduce social anxiety. To learn more, stay tuned for our upcoming For the People segment on these studies or call them now at 203-737-4644 for the Yale Child Study Center. Well, good morning once again. We are in the second segment of a two-part series here during National Suicide Prevention and Awareness Month. As we began the conversation last week with our guest, Dr. Kathleen Chapman, who is with the Connecticut Advisory Board for Suicide Prevention, we reminded folks that not only is the entire month of September devoted toward preventing and being aware of the warning signs and reaching out and providing the necessary help and support and just being there for people who might be so desolate that they're considering suicide. There was also a Suicide Prevention Week, which was celebrated last week, and World Suicide Prevention Day on September 10th. Here, as we move into the middle of the month, we're going to pick up the conversation with Dr. Chapman, who is also a clinical psychologist on the board of the Connecticut Psychological Association, and she's the representative for public interest for that organization. She's also been providing education on suicide prevention throughout the state, and she's been involved in implementing best practices in suicide risk assessment and intervention in a community mental health center as well. A fantastic resource here during Suicide Prevention and Awareness Month. Dr. Chapman, welcome back.
Thank you so much, John. I'm so glad to be back to talk about this important topic.
So as we know, those of us who are the left behinders, as I refer to myself and others who are facing a life without a loved one due to suicide, this is a very complex and personal issue, but the most important thing is to be able to not feel stigmatized about talking about it, whether you're worried about somebody who you feel might be considering suicide or talking about an individual we may have lost to suicide.
That is so important, John. I think that people sometimes aren't aware of the impact of stigma in our society, And it can have subtle effects. All of us, have grown up in our society and kind of share the same beliefs. So sometimes when we're faced with some mental health issues or things are not going well and we feel stressed or maybe feel like things are getting worse, for some of us, it may feel like difficult to reach out and ask for help. We may feel like, well, my family relies on me. I have to be strong. I can't be needing help right now. Or there's something wrong with me if I ask for help. I won't feel competent. And it's just important to recognize those feelings and thoughts and acknowledge them and recognize that we all have learned this growing up, but actually they're not true. And it is important to reach out for help for all of us.
So for the over the past near quarter century, suicide has increased about 33%, and it's the 11th leading cause of death in Connecticut. But you need to also look at the Surgeon General's National Strategy for Suicide Prevention in 2001, which has since been updated. These are important benchmarks and statistics to consider when you're looking at what has seemed to become a real national public health crisis.
Yes, absolutely. It has been since 2008. Suicide has been the 10th among the top 10 leading causes of death across the nation, and it's different for different groups. There's different cultural groups, different communities are impacted more than others, and certain age groups as well. Certainly, it's a big issue for young adults and young people, as we mentioned last week. It's about the second leading cause of death for people under the age of around 25, from 10 to 25. Additionally, for those who are living in communities who might be hard hit by the pandemic, who have experienced housing instability, job loss, food insecurity, there is some indication that suicide rates are higher in those communities, as well as rates have been increasing for men, middle-aged and older, and have been increasing for women as well. And I just want to remind people that these are very hard issues to talk about. It's something that's difficult to think about. And for many of us, our lives have been touched in one way or another by suicide. So I just want to encourage people, if any of this is upsetting, if it's feels at all distressing, to take a break, certainly reach out. As I mentioned last week, in Connecticut, you can call 211. At 211, you'll reach a crisis counselor who will listen, and as well as link you to any services if needed. And there's also the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 800-273-8255. As well as the crisis text line, which is 741-741. And the information that we're talking about is really general and meant to help in finding ways to support people who are dealing with thoughts of suicide, and not really intended to apply to any one individual, since, as John mentioned, it is such a complex and personal issue.
Well, we did spend a bit of time in the initial segment, Dr. Chapman, talking about young people with this incredible and very, very disturbing news of the incidence of suicide attempts for girls aged 12 to 17, increasing over 50% in 2020 alone compared to the same period in 2019, where the increase for boys of the same age range was just 3.6%. And I guess the conversation around girls and girl teen suicide ideation and situations is one for another day. We could probably spend an entire segment on that. But let's broaden our focus right now to educate people on some of the risk factors and warning signs of suicide.
Oh, absolutely. It's so important to be aware of this information. And I just want to encourage people, as we're going through this, it's going to be a lot of information. You can access this information and all the main points that we're going to be talking about through the National Institute of Mental Health site, or NIM. And as you go to the National Institute of Mental Health site, you'll see right when you get on the site, information about suicide prevention, and they will have this information, so don't feel like you have to write everything down or anything. Additionally, the Connecticut Suicide Advisory Board site also has this information as well. So be sure to use these resources. They're very helpful. So in talking about risk factors, we're talking about ongoing challenges and stress for an individual, and they can include several different areas: biological, someone has an ongoing illness, pain, central nervous system disorder, a chronic illness like heart disease, social, feeling a lack of belonging. That is a big risk factor, feeling isolated, like someone doesn't belong. Relationship difficulties, bullying, interpersonal violence is also a big risk factor. Someone has experienced violence in their life. There's also psychological risk factors that can include emotional pain, history of a difficult childhood with abuse or frequent disruption, or experiencing depression, anxiety, substance abuse, history of suicidal behavior, or multiple attempts. Also, there's environmental risk factors, like social isolation or ready access to lethal means. And when we talk about lethal means, we talk about things like medications, other things around the house that could be used in making a suicide attempt, or access to guns. Mm-hmm. The thing that's important to remember about risk factors is most people who have any of these risk factors are not going to make a suicide attempt. So this information lets us know about an individual's ongoing experience and their risk level. And these risk factors also interact with each other. So knowing this about an individual is just something to kind of alert us that just to stay in touch with someone, be talking with them, just checking in, how are they doing, is there anything that's getting hard to deal with, and be sure to include that person in activities, meaningful things that are going on in your life, whether it's like activity outdoors or book clubs. Make sure people are not isolated, making sure that people have support and connection, and also just being aware of what's in the house that could possibly be a method of making a suicide attempt.
Okay. I was going to say in the last 5 minutes or so that we have with you, Dr. Chapman, I'd like to also make sure that we are doing our due diligence and helping everyone listening to play a role in breaking down the stigma by teaching them a few talking points about what to say and what to do if they are worried, if they're seeing some of the warning signs that you're describing, or know that someone that they love is under one or more of these burdens. What are a few of the most important things that people need to know about what to say?
Yes, that's such a good point. So I'll just quickly say that these risk factors can interact with life events. So someone is living with these risk factors and suddenly something happens in their life. They've lost a relationship. Something happens where they have a new medical diagnosis, or they've been arrested or something like that that's very stressful in their lives. This is a time to be asking someone how they're doing, And being aware of any warning signs that something is changing with that person, that maybe they're letting you know that they'd be better off dead, or they're joking about suicide, or looking at their behavior. Are they looking up ways to die? Are they hoarding medication? So it's very important in asking them, just using plain language, starting off with, how are you doing? And asking, are you thinking about suicide? We talk about plain language because it sets a tone of acceptance and honesty, and it provides clarity. We all know what we're talking about. So using words like suicide, die by suicide, or suicide attempt.
Yeah, I was going to say, introducing the word suicide as quickly as possible, but as mindfully as possible in the conversation is so important.
It is. I mean, obviously, you want to start off in a way that allows a person to talk, how are things going, and then being sure to listen. It's not a time to give advice or tell people, oh, things aren't that bad. You want people to feel comfortable sharing what they're thinking, what they're experiencing, and then, as appropriate, be asking them about suicide. For children, you may be asking them, does something seem like too big of a problem? Are you doing okay? But at some point, it is important to ask about suicide directly. If you're concerned, make sure that you're aware of what's in the house. Keep the individual safe and stay with them. Help them to connect with help, with services. Maybe go with them, drive them there. And what's something that's very, very important, and people aren't aware of it, one big risk factor is after someone has left treatment, or if they've gone into the hospital, left the hospital, stay connected with that person. That is one of the number one most effective ways to help someone, is just those caring contacts. How a phone call, a note, reaching out are so helpful and important.
If there is an imminent concern about the possibility of suicide, of course, anyone within the sounds of our voices should call 911. Your emergency dispatchers and professionals across Connecticut are all trained in how to handle these situations and will get help to that individual in an emergent way as quickly as possible. You also can call 211 in Connecticut, info line for adults and children. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255, or you can text the crisis text line at 741-741. And Dr. Chapman, there are also references available through the Your Psychological Association here in Connecticut that can connect individuals to in-person assistance, right?
Absolutely. Yes, you can go to the Connecticut Psychological Association website.
Very good. Well, we thank you for all of the valuable information over the past couple of weeks, and hope and believe it will make a difference in both educating and preventing potential suicides here in our state. We thank you for your work as well with the and the Connecticut Advisory Board for Suicide Prevention, and all the work that you do in your practice. Appreciate the resource, and we hope to talk with you again soon about this important subject. Thanks for being part of the program. Well, regular listeners know how much we love our farmers and agriculture and aquaculture industries here in Connecticut on the award-winning For the People. And with Farm Aid coming in next weekend, we are so excited to get the United States Department of Agriculture on the phone line with us to tout a great new program. Jonathan Burns is on the line. He's a business and cooperative program specialist with the USDA, and they have just granted 10 Connecticut agricultural businesses over $115,000 to distribute amongst them as part of their Rural Energy for America, or their REAP program. And we're going to talk all about it here in this midpoint segment. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, John, and take the opportunity to spotlight some of the great things that we're doing here to help rural communities, ag producers and small businesses. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, so we talked for a couple seconds before we opened up the microphone. You're not from a farm family. You're a finance guy, but landed in the right place and are now really doing important work for farmers, not just here in Connecticut, but across the nation. I mean, the REAP program looks like financing tens of millions of dollars across the country, and very exciting that 10 of these projects are happening right here in Connecticut. So anything else our listeners might want to know about USDA or the REAP grants?
There really is quite a lot to talk about, but just to kind of dovetail on what you were just saying, is it really is a great feeling to have the position to be able to work on something that we care about, and that I can tell that you're passionate about it too. I mean, the work that we're doing here really makes a difference. Some of these grants may not be very large, but they make a direct impact on the bottom line for the businesses of our farmers. I mean, with margins being so small right now, it really feels good to be able to get behind a mission that that we're all a part of.
Excellent.
So, yeah, I'm interested in and learning more about and spotlighting everything.
Excellent. Well, we've got about 14 minutes or so to spotlight each of these 10 recipients. So, gentlemen, start your engines and let's talk about Freud's Farm Market and Bakery up in East Canaan, Connecticut. They received a little over $10,000 from the REAP grant allocation. Tell us a little bit about what Freund's Farm Market and Bakery is doing with their allocation.
Well, Freund's Farm is using their REAP grant for energy efficiency improvements. It's one of the two eligible purposes for the grant. And what they're doing is they're putting in some high-efficiency glass door produce coolers at their farmers market. So if you ever go into a store and they have all the produce in the open cases, that's just open to the rest of the air, and it's very wasteful.
Yes.
So what we're doing is we're helping to fund those glass doors to help really capture a lot of that savings there.
Yeah, and I guess it bears mentioning that these days, like any business, agricultural businesses have a profit margin that's hanging right on the razor's edge. So anywhere they could save a dollar, never mind $100 or $1,000, is a dollar earned toward the bottom line. So all of these grants aren't just a dollar for dollar type of cost value. Really, the dollars that our Americans paid through the USDA and our kind of universal tax dollars are helping these businesses, by giving them a dollar, but possibly helping them save thousands. So that's really the most exciting part of this whole thing. So let's hear about Hunter Mathena, which is up in Berlin. His family farm received a $9,000-plus grant. What's cooking up with the Mathena farm in Berlin?
They're going to be expanding their farm operations, which is always exciting. So what they're going to be doing is to help offset their future energy needs and their current needs. They're putting in a solar array. Mm-hmm. So it's really exciting to see help these small farmers really expand the operations. That's exciting.
Yeah, they're looking at producing more than 18,000 kilowatt hours from this new program. So very much evidence of how, the $9,000 is going to be generating tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in savings over the next 20 plus years. And folks, of course, as we talk about each of these businesses, think about patronizing them. Hunter Mathena's family raises beef, cattle, chickens, and sheep in Berlin. So if they are available for public consumption, consider visiting them, as well as Broadbrook Acres over in Preston. They've got a $20,000 grant. What's cooking with them, Jonathan?
Yes, they're going to be offsetting 100% of their electrical usage for the solar array that they're going to be putting in. So how exciting is that, that Broadbrook Acres is going to be offsetting all of their electricity? I mean, that's really great.
Yeah, totally, not necessarily unplugging from the grid, but certainly making a minimal impact, and that's great. Broadbrook Acres raises and butchers their own animals to sell to their community, and maybe you if you visit them up in Preston at Broadbrook Acres. Next, we're down to Granby and the Cavallo Farm. They've got $7,000 plus from the REAP grant program. Mr. Burns, it looks like they're also, you've got a lot of solar going on with these farms, huh?
Yeah, that's the 800-pound gorilla in the room is a solar, yeah.
Sure, that's great. Yeah, mm-hmm. So their offset is, they're looking at saving more than $3,000 a year with their solar array. And it looks like they're looking at trying to produce or replace about 15,000 plus kilowatt hours. Fat Orange Cat Brew Company in East Hampton has also received $20,000 for a solar array. And they are a small seasonal homestead brewery located in East Hampton. Jonathan, do you know anything or much more about Fat Orange Cat Brew Company? Are they housed in a farm situation? Or how does a seasonal brewery factor into all this? That is really considered an agricultural pursuit.
Yeah, well, for the REAP program, the eligible applicants are either agricultural producers or small businesses that are located in rural areas.
Ah, I see.
So an agricultural producer can be anywhere, but a rural small business, they need to be in a rural area.
Excellent. I failed to mention Cavallo Farms up there in Granby that we were talking about with their solar array. They're a horse farm that's a show and boarding facility with indoor and outdoor rings up there in Granby. Mm-hmm. So let's take a quick break here, Jonathan. We're going to just provide a couple of public service announcements, and we'll be back to talk to you and wrap up our conversation this morning here about the REAP grants through the USDA. Stick around, folks, and hear more about the farmers that are growing and small businesses that are helping Connecticut and going to be receiving more support thanks to this great program through the United States Department of Agriculture. We'll be right back. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Well, you've heard of us talking about the WBDC, the Women's Business Development Council, on the award-winning For the People for a long, long time. And we're so happy to announce that their latest Equity Match Grant program for women-owned businesses in Connecticut is accepting applications through September 28th. So you got to act fast, but you can get your hands on grants between $2,500 and $10,000 for clearly defined projects that'll have a measurable impact on your business, its growth, and profitability. The grant program is designed to help position Connecticut-based women-owned businesses for growth. The grant funds cannot be used toward operating expenses, payroll, or real estate improvements, however. Applicants are required to provide a minimum 25% match, and applications are going to be accepted online once again through September 28th. If you need to find out more and get qualified and get your application in, just go to ctwbdc.org. All right, we're back with Jonathan Burns. He's a business and cooperative program specialist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The USDA has recently granted $115,749 to help Connecticut businesses in rural areas and agricultural producers build back better and lower their energy costs through this REAP grant program, Rural Energy for America program is what REAP stands for. And we're kind of just ticking off the list here. Cowpots LLC in East Canaan. We have read about this unique and interesting business. They are also going to be doing a solar project as well as LED lighting up at their location. Jonathan, tell us more about Cowpots for those who may not be able to guess what they're all about.
Yeah, Cowpots is it's actually pretty interesting. They manufacture plant containers from cow manure, believe it or not, and it's made from recyclable, renewable, composted cow manure. So it's actually really exciting.
So they're between the LED project and the solar work that they're doing, they're looking at offsetting about 25% of their energy costs per year. That's great. New England Meatpacking in Stafford Springs, way up in Stafford Springs, they got a little over $9,000 through the program. Looks like for some solar offset or LED lighting, right?
Yes, that's correct. Yep, they're going to be saving 9% per year, which doesn't seem like it's a lot, but like you mentioned before, you know, margins are very small, and every little bit helps and every little bit hurts.
Yep, this facility serves New England farmers, residents, and growing businesses with fresh quality meats up there in Stafford Springs. The next recipient also looks like LED lighting installation is Running Brook Farm in Killingworth. Jonathan, what can you tell us about this organization?
Running Brook Farm, they are going to be installing LED lights, which is, it's always a very big bang for your buck that you get when you're doing energy efficiency. You can really save a lot of energy by installing LED lights. And luckily, we were able to award them a grant to save over half of their annual energy usage per year.
Yeah, I guess with the projected savings of almost $4,000, that's like payroll for a part-time worker, or could really offset the cost of repairing a vehicle or something. So, I mean, we're not talking small change here, and the potential long-term savings, I guess, on these LED and solar projects could be apparently much higher. We've got two more recipients of these REAP program grants. Ginger Creek Nursery in Norfolk has received a little over $10,000. Jonathan, what's the story on Ginger Creek Nursery?
Yeah, they're going to be putting in a ground mount solar array to replace a little over 12,000 kilowatt hours of energy that they've been using historically, which is exciting for them. It's great.
Excellent.
Their nursery that they have organic plants, compost, tea. They have several offerings.
Well, yeah, folks can just find Route 8, take it all the way to the end, and basically just start heading west to beautiful Norfolk, Connecticut. They retail sale to the public on their organic plant materials and compost, as well as other products. Finally, our last 2021 REAP grantee is Smokedown Farm in Sharon. They've got almost $20,000, and it looks like they're also going solar or improving their solar facilities, right, Jonathan?
Yeah, that's correct. They're putting in a little bit larger of a array for 20 kilowatts. So that's going to realize $3,100 of savings per year. So that can make a definite difference on their bottom line.
And the reason I've heard of Smokedown Farm is because a number of the microbreweries and small breweries here in Connecticut get their hops from Smokedown Farm. They're a 9-acre farm that grows seven different varieties of hops. So if you're tipping back a cold one or an interesting micro brew at one of your favorite local micro breweries, very good chance that maybe the hops that went into that brew came from Smokedown Farms up in Sharon. So in the last minute or two that we have, Jonathan, tell us a little bit more about how small businesses and farms can look forward to maybe applying for or qualifying for the next round of REAP program grants?
Well, the next application deadline, there's two deadlines every year, the end of October and the end of March. So the next deadline is at the end of October. And if a rural small business or agricultural producer is interested in applying, they can contact me directly. They could contact other organizations that help assemble grant applications, like Connecticut Farm Energy, perhaps. That's all they really have to do is just start the conversation, and just remember that, you know, these are federal tax dollars. It's not going to, shouldn't cost you anything to apply for them. Although if you want, you can hire grant writers. But let's just start with a conversation and figure out what it is that you're trying to accomplish and, whether or not we can help you meet those goals.
Excellent. Jonathan Burns is uniquely qualified to help with his background in finance. He is the business and cooperative program specialist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture under the Biden-Harris administration. Rural development provides loans and grants to help expand economic opportunities, create jobs, improve the quality of life for millions of Americans in rural areas, certainly many thousands here in Connecticut, thanks to this recent round of grants. This assistance supports infrastructure improvements, business development, housing, community facilities like schools, public safety and health care, high-speed internet access, and more. If you'd like to learn more, go to rd.usda.gov/CT, and it'll take you right down to what's happening here in Connecticut. Jonathan, great to meet you. Thanks for being on the show today. It's great to meet new friends here on the award-winning For the People, even if they have endured a challenging situation in their own lives. I'm so pleased to have Phil and Andrea Morella on the program representing DART, Dana's Angels Research Trust. And they're going to be holding a walk, DART to the Finish, charity walk for Dana's Angels Research Trust. That's coming up on Saturday, September 25th at Greenwich Point Park. We're going to talk all about that in a little while, but it'll be a lot easier to appreciate and engage with the DART to the Finish charity walk by learning a little bit more about the Morella family and the great work they're doing, not only in raising awareness, like through their appearance on our program, but also in backing critical research toward trying to find a cure and treatments for Niemann-Pick-type C disease, which is sometimes referred to as children's Alzheimer's. Greetings to you, Phil and Andrea. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon.
Us. So,
I could briefly fill you in.
Yeah, sure, Andrea. What's give us a little bit backstory first on you folks and your family story.
Well, Phil and I, we were blessed with four children, two girls and then two boys. And about 19 years ago, when our daughter was eight, let's say, she was diagnosed with Niemann-Pick type C. We were devastated. We were told it was rare and degenerative and fatal. So, of course, any parent's nightmare. And 3 years later, our son, Andrew, was diagnosed, our youngest, at the age of five. So when Dana was diagnosed, we started a foundation. People wanted to help us, and we called it Dana's Angels Research Trust. And we started fundraising because, as we all know, there's very little funding for very rare diseases. So we knew it took family foundations to do that. And we've been raising funds ever since. We've been very, very fortunate in this community to have raised over $5.5 million. I'd say over 95% of that has gone directly to the research, which Phil will be happy to share with you where we're at. We've come a long way. Sadly, our daughter Dana did pass away 8 years ago after her battle. She could no longer walk or talk. She had a feeding tube since she was 11, and then she had to have a trach in her last year. But she was a beautiful and very affectionate, wonderful little girl who moved a lot of people here and around the world, frankly. And now we are dealing with our son's issues. He's doing far better. He's been very fortunate to be in a drug trial for the last 7.5 years that has really slowed down the progression of the disease. Our daughter did not benefit from that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So Phil, maybe you want to add to the trial.
Yeah, I was going to ask. Let me just ask you guys. Has there been a particular medical center or academic institution that has an acute interest in Niemann-Pick type C who has partnered with you, or are you even more fortunate to have a number of research and potential treatment partners?
Well, you know, John, it's thank you again. It's, you know, the fortunate side of the story is that the gene that's involved here, the Niemann-Pick gene, the NPC gene, there's actually sort of two. There's an NPC1 and an NPC2, and they work together to transport cholesterol around the cells so that it gets properly used. And because of this being really the building block of cholesterol metabolism, we have just about the most brilliant group of scientists you can imagine working on a rare disease. Mm. Niemann-Pick is actually an ultra rare disease. Sometimes you hear 1 in 100,000 births, sometimes 1 in 120,000 births, something in that range. We have about 200 patients in the country right now, but having one company did a study and almost the most we could count on eventually might be 600. So that's a very, very, very rare disease. And yet, we have research institutes at Stanford, at Princeton. Mm. We do an awful lot of work with the National Institutes of Health, the University of Pennsylvania, Weill Cornell in Columbia, and Albert Einstein here in the New York area. We have Nobel Prize winning researchers down at the University of Texas Southwestern, University of Michigan, Notre Dame, Memorial Sloan Kettering even. There's some programs there, Dartmouth, Washington University. I mean, wow. It's a very, very impressive group of researchers that
dream team of heavy hitters in terms of the institutions.
It is. And, and they came to it because of the cholesterol metabolism issues. You know, there are people that are more interested in heart disease and stroke and Alzheimer's. You know, we talk about childhood Alzheimer's. There's a dementia component, serious dementia component to Niemann-Pick. And when you talk to many Alzheimer's researchers, their focus has been on the plaques and trying to bring relief to patients, which is perfectly understandable. But many of them will tell you that if you work your way up that cascade of events, many of them believe that that these dementias are often related to some sort of a cholesterol metabolism defect. So a lot of these people came to the cause because of the ability to study cholesterol metabolism in a very narrow way. And yet, we have an amazing community of families around the country like ours that raise money in their communities. And they've gotten to know the researchers, and the researchers have gotten to know the families and the children. And they're very, very engaged in trying to help us do this. We've had 4 clinical trials. Andrew has been on one drug for 17 years. Mm-hmm. It's approved just about every place but the United States. But we know that that's helping. Andrea mentioned the other drug trial that he's been in for a little over 7 years, 7.5 years. Mm-hmm. We're actually trying to get a center for treatment in the Northeast for that drug at Yale New Haven. That would be for multiple patients. That's a drug that we're still trying to get through the FDA. We have a third drug that the FDA is we're still working with the FDA on. It's very difficult when you have a rare disease to really show the kind of change that the FDA wants. So there's a whole process going on where we're trying to educate the FDA and get our doctors, our clinicians, our researchers.
Yeah. Well,
let me educate the FDA on the importance.
No, I wanted to ask, you did mention or inferred that at least one of the drugs is almost universally approved and accepted and being utilized. Globally, does the proportion of victims or individuals who are affected by Niemann-Pick type C similar to the ratio that we see here in the United States? Is it or are there other areas of the globe where this disease is more concentrated, or other hot spots that have larger concentrations of children with this illness?
Not particularly. The 1 in 110,000 number comes mostly from our experience with the disease in Europe, where they have a very different system. You know, they have particular hospitals throughout Europe that deal with rare diseases. Mm-hmm. So if you're diagnosed with Niemann-Pick and you live in London, there's a particular hospital that you're going to go to. You know,
so
it, whereas we don't have that here, we have experts here at Rush and at the NIH and at the Mayo Clinic,
sure,
certainly, and some others at UCLA and places, we don't have centers like that. So
yeah, it sounds more like treetop offices.
That's a pretty good number globally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now,
so
the other question I had was, while it is a rare disease, 600 give or take in the U.S. right now, what is the proportion or the likelihood of Niemann-Pick type C to affect siblings, as was in your case? Does that make your case and the Morella family even more unique, or is it a condition that could replicate across siblings?
Well, it's really when you have what they call a recessive defect, both parents have to be a carrier.
Mm.
And if you're a carrier, in theory, you don't have any of the disease manifestations. So Andrea has a particular mutation. I have a particular mutation. Therefore, each time you have a child, there's a 1 in 4 chance of that child actually getting the disease, a 2 in 4 chance of them being a carrier, and a 1 in 4 chance of them being completely clear.
Mm.
So, yes, I mean, it's unfortunate we are on the wrong side of the statistics, having 2 of 4 instead of 1 of 4. Many people may be familiar with the former football coach at Notre Dame, Ara Parseghian. He had 4 grandchildren, and 3 of the 4 had it. So they were on the wrong side of the statistic there as well. They're one of the Parseghian Fund, which is now at Notre Dame, is one of our closest partners in research.
Okay. Well, before we go on before we go on and talk about the charity walk, and listeners, I have to apologize. We're on a little bit of a phone delay here through our conference system, so there's a little bit of a overlap on the conversation here. But Phil and Andrea, before we go on and invite people to meet you and learn more about Niemann-Pick type C and Dana's Angels Research Trust, I guess my final question regarding the illness is, do you have such prolific and high profile interest among your research partners because there are enough similarities between Niemann-Pick type C and Alzheimer's that, in studying Niemann-Pick type C, there is an idea that it will not only help individuals who contract it, but also can be utilized in other types of Alzheimer's or dementia diseases?
That's yes. A lot of the companies, we have about 12 companies right now that are looking at developing therapy programs for Niemann-Pick, and their primary focus broadly is on neurological disease.
Okay.
And we have a very, very, this is like a small Petri dish compared to a giant Petri dish.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Alzheimer's is a label. There's probably many different causes. Whereas with Niemann-Pick, you're studying this particular chemical reaction, in a sense, this protein. What does this protein do? So it gives them a narrow window. the gentleman that won the Nobel Prize in Medicine back in 1985 for discovering statin drugs were actually studying an even more rare pediatric blood disorder. And yet that small petri dish led them to a treatment for tens and tens of millions of people around the world.
Wow.
So that's sort of the concept, is that it's easier to find things you can do in a smaller petri dish.
Okay.
And that's what we provide.
Well, let's put the power of our gracious and very proactive listening audiences to For the People and our radio stations to work. Even though this Niemann Pick Type C impacts around 600 families here in the United States at any one time, certainly you've clearly explained how supporting research has much, much greater implications. So throw it back to you, Phil or Dana or both. Just give us the details and let's get people out on what we hope will be a gorgeous September 25th down to Greenwich Point Park for the Dart to the Finish charity walk. What are the details?
Well, it'll actually be a win-win for your audience, because you can not only help a very good cause and help us, you know, fund more research, but you can enjoy, like you said, a beautiful day at the most beautiful beach in Greenwich. And it is no charge for anyone coming who says they're there for the Dart Walk. So at the entrance gate, everyone's welcome. We paid for a global guest pass for all to come. So we have a lot of outsiders coming from all over.
Mm.
So please feel free to join us. It starts at 8:30 in the morning. It's our fourth annual walk. Last year we had it all virtual. This year we have many signed up in person, and we have quite a few as well virtually. So either way, it benefits Dana's Angels. We'll be providing water bottles and granola bars to all the walkers. We'll have games and face painting for kids. We are hoping to raise over $125,000. We welcome everyone. Right now, we're probably about almost 200 people, but we are welcoming many more. And we will have a DJ there for fun music.
Great.
Well, did I forget anything, Phil?
Well, it's $25 for adults, $10 for children from ages 10 to 21, free for children under that. And of course, that registration fee, if you will, is a donation.
Sure.
In itself.
Very good.
And you can just you can sign up at the event, or you can go to dartevents.org, and it'll take you right to the race registration page.
Great.
dartevents.org.
If listeners found something that they'd like to learn more about through our conversation this morning with our guests, you can also go to danasangels.org to learn more and get involved with this very unique but critically important nonprofit here in Southern Connecticut. Dana's Angels Research Trust, DART, was founded by Andrea and Phil Morella, our guests this morning, after two of their four children, Dana and Andrew, were diagnosed with Niemann Pick type C disease. Dana sadly passed away at age 19, but as we heard, Andrew, who turned 22 in June, is doing better due to being enrolled in a clinical trial to slow the progression of the disease, which was funded through this organization. Global implications here, folks, and you can put your feet to work in making things better for all the families here in the United States and around the world that are grappling with a child or one or more children with Niemann Pick type C disease. We thank you guys for educating us this morning. I learned a lot, and I wish you luck on the walk, and I look forward to talking with you guys again at some point next year. I know, Andrea, you have a shopping event coming up in downtown Greenwich at the holiday season. So we
yes,
also
we
want,
actually
yeah,
will.
Yeah,
yes.
I want to have people go to your website
on December
to keep
9th.
Yep. And they can also
find it on our website.
danasangels.org.
Right. December 9th, shopping night on Greenwich Avenue.
You can't beat it. A beautiful place to be and a great cause to support if you can't make the walk on September 25th down at Greenwich Point Park. Phil and Andrea, thank you so much for the program this morning. I learned so much, and I hope our listeners turn out like crazy to get to know you and continue to support Dana's Angels Research Trust. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.